The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Sunday Space Show. Great to be back live, given that I was away for a good part of the week at the New Space Conference in Santa Clara. This is open line, so all of your calls are welcome, space-related topics. We hope to hear from you, and new callers are certainly welcome. You can give us a call, and right now the toll-free line is not connected up, and that's because I'm going to make a few announcements. But I'll tell you when it's open, but jot down the number, 1-866-687-7223. There are no call screeners. Let it ring until I can answer it and bring you up on air. If it's busy, it's because somebody's using the line. We only have one line. So don't complain that it's busy. But I'll tell you, listeners, hopefully you'll learn to be succinct, because people don't like to usually wait, and often we lose some potentially very interesting calls just because people stay on the line a long, long, long time. But we do have a surprise first segment for you, which I'll tell you about in just a minute. But do visit our website, and it is thespaceshow.com, and we have a comprehensive newsletter there, and I'll upload it to the website after today's program. And it will tell you all about the programs for this coming week, and we have 5 programs this week. So check it out on the website newsletter, because that's where you'll find all the bios and the details of the program. The email newsletter gets mailed out tomorrow morning, early, 6 a.m. California time. If you want a subscription to that, it's very, very short. Just send me your email address, and I'll be happy to do that. Everything we're doing is archived going back to 01, so you can listen right off of our website, or you can easily download the shows. There's a store on our website. It's up near the top. Please do check it out. It's called Space Show Gear. And then probably the most important button there is the support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with one giant, leapfoundation.org. And this program only exists because many of you do support it and make contributions, and we hope many more of you will do the same thing so we can keep the Space Show going, and we do appreciate that. Remember, if you're a U.S. taxpayer, you do get a deduction at the federal level. And if you're a California taxpayer, you get a deduction as well at the California level. And then you can reach us by email at drspace@thespaceshow.com, including that toll-free number I gave you, 866-687-7223. Remember, we podcast, and we thank Andrew over at gigadial.net, but you can find us in iTunes and Microsoft soon and a host of other places. And you can subscribe to our podcast by looking at either our website newsletter, the email newsletter, or our website. And then do remember, we are a copyrighted program, and we are trademarked. So we do give you permission to download these programs. An hour and a half show is roughly 40 megabytes. They're highly compressed MP3s. And just don't do anything commercial with the shows. No edits, no private YouTube channels or anything like that. And we don't permit written transcripts, even if they're for your own use. We don't even have permission from our guest to do written transcripts. So please honor that request, and we do really appreciate you for doing that. Remember that we're brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. They promote cooperative solutions for space security. Please do visit their website. It is secureworldfoundation.org. So couple of quick announcements, and then I'll introduce you to our first we're going to have a guest that I met at the conference, and we're going to talk about that for a few minutes. But the New Space Conference was pretty darn good. It is evolving. It is getting better and better each year, more and more professional, less fantasy, less Kool-Aid, but, you know, some of that still obviously exists. But, you know, I was impressed, and I'm glad I attended it. And for those of you that don't know, it was live-streamed at Space Vidcast. I hope I'm saying that correctly. But it's archived there, and you can see all the segments, and you can download them or play them off of their website, and you can get the content of the conference. So I suggest you do that. Many of the panels, especially some of the panels with Pete Warden and some of the other people, were really exceptional. I think you'll find it most informative and in many ways cutting edge. Make sure you see the business plan competition. I was a coach for the business plan for Wednesday afternoon into the end of the day on Thursday. And my team that I coached actually won second place. They got the $10,000 prize, and I'll tell you who won the first prize in just a minute. But watch that competition at the conference. You don't get to see boot camp, but you will see the actual presentations of the pitches that the business plan guys made. And I'm telling you, some of these business plans were exceptional. I mean, there's a plan that got honorable mention for a potential mitigation cure or real help in dealing with radiation. And you need to listen to how they explained it. They've already gotten an enormous amount of agency and government funding, and NASA's very interested in talking to them and being a customer. And they're going through the FDA process, and, you know, it's pretty fascinating. That was an amazing, you know, business opportunity. Our friend Armin Ellis, he had a terrific plan for how to use CubeSats to help mitigate damage in an offshore oil spill anywhere around the world. And apparently you can launch 5 CubeSats in kind of random orbits in a certain way, like they're all secondary payloads, so you don't get to really control your orbit. But you can blanket the globe and cover most of the oil platforms in the seas to see oil spills and stuff. And Armin didn't win first or second, but there are people there that are interested in talking to him, because there were a lot of people from Silicon Valley at the conference. So even for companies that didn't win first or second prize, many of them now have their foot in the door to the VC, the angel, and to financial possibilities. So it's pretty darn exciting. And having done the new space business plans pretty much since they've started doing this, going way, way back, I can tell you that this was the best year ever. As to who won, and I want to tell you who won, and then we'll sort of go on and get into our program today. First place went to a company that is managed and run by Rick Sanford. Rick has been a guest on the space show way back when he worked at Cisco Systems, and he has since gone out on his own, and his company is called Space Ground, you know, like ground, Amalgam, and they provide inflatable satellite reflector components to meet and increase higher industry bandwidth demands while reducing launch cost and increasing design flexibility. So basically, it's an inflatable that when it inflates, it becomes rigid and it expands the capacity in K-band significantly. And Space Ground Amalgam won the $100,000 grand prize that NASA was giving out. And Rick will shortly be back on the space show. The team that I coached and that won second prize out of Reno is Digital Solid State Propulsion, LLC. And they have smart engine materials. And what they do is they have their own solid propellants, and then they can electronically turn them on and off. And this has amazing ramifications in defense, military, oil and mining, entertainment. I mean, it's just across the board, and of course, space. And so they won the second prize, and Wayne and his team are going to be up at SmallSat, but I'm pretty sure after SmallSat is over with, Wayne or some of his team members will be a guest on the space show. The team that got honorable mention, Terapeo, is a biopharmaceutical company. It's the one I told you about that is mitigating radiation. And they're developing therapeutics based on the membrane-associated RLIP, R-L-I-P, 76 protein. They modify this naturally occurring protein, and they've been testing it on animals, and it's unbelievable for mitigating radiation damage. And you'll hear the doctor who presented for them talk about this if you actually go and listen to their presentation. So they were amazing and very, very exciting. And as I said, we hear that NASA may be already interested in them. And go check them out on the business plan presentation. It's quite impressive. And my hat goes off to all three of these, but there were 10 competitors. And the other seven were pretty amazing companies as well. And as you know, there can only be one winner. There can only be one second winner. And they added honorable mention because this radiation mitigation company was so impressive and so close to the others that while they didn't get any money, they had to get at least some recognition as a winner. But again, all of the 10 companies were pretty darn amazing. There was an exhibit area out there, and Space Systems Loral was out there, and they actually were talking to people about career stuff, and they made a whole presentation with a party and food and drinks. SpaceX had an entire presentation in the evening on SpaceX. They catered it, free food, free drinks, very, very informative. ATK was there regarding Liberty. And they gave special press briefings on the Liberty rocket. There were a host of other companies there, and one of them is a new space company. And he's called the Space Show before, but this is a chap, Paul Graham. He's the project manager. I'm going to bring him up on the program in just a minute. But his company or his program is called Open Luna, one word, L-U-N-A, and it's Canadian and American. And they want to put humans on the moon. And he took out a booth there in the exhibit hall, and he had some hardware on exhibit. And, you know, I noticed a lot of people were stopping by and talking to him and engaging him in discussions. So I told him to call in on open lines and give us an update, because he did call in once before, and tell us about what happened at the conference, what Open Luna is doing. And, Paul, are you there? Paul? Hello? What happened to Paul? Paul, are you there? Paul? Oh, wow. Did we lose Paul? I don't know what happened to Paul. Paul, are you there? Well, I guess we may have lost him. Interesting. Hold on a minute. I'll try to get him back. Okay. So you guys just sit tight for a minute. I'm not going to go to break. I think I can get him back real quickly. So just hang tight. Paul, are you with us?
I am.
Okay. You got the microphone. I just introduced you and talked about your booth at New Space, and that you have called in and told us about Open Luna before. So tell us what you're doing and what's new.
Well, as you may or may not know, Luna, we've spun off two for-profit companies. I mean, Open Luna, just so all the listeners know, we're a privately funded, open-source, return humankind to the moon mission, and our intentions are to build an outpost on the lunar surface in the next 5 to 7 years. We're doing it using, as I said, open-source build techniques, which means everything we have is open and available to the public, and we're doing it all private funding.
Do you have timelines? What's your next step? Where do you go from here?
Well, we're doing, you know, as almost everybody in this business is, we're doing fundraising right now. We're engaging in the campaign to let the public know about our efforts and what we're working on. It's a big chunk of our mission expects public involvement. We really, I mean, it's everyone's mission. I mean, after all, it's your moon. It should be your mission, so we're telling everyone to get involved.
Okay, so.
So right now, public awareness, fundraising, that's the big thing we're pushing on. We've got some hardware, we're bending metal, we've done some engine testing, some hardware testing. I've actually flown our lander once, and we're upgrading it and moving some of the engineering to Canada right now.
So do you have any problem moving stuff to Canada? Does ITAR or anything like that enter into it?
Well, we don't directly move anything to Canada. What we've done is we've abandoned certain technologies in the States, and a team of Canadian engineers is basically re-engineering it clean sheet. So there's no ITAR encumbrances there.
Okay. If people want to learn more or get in touch with you, how do they get that information? Where can they get more data and check in with you?
Well, openluna.org is kind of the center of everything we do. From there, you can find the wiki, which is where a lot of this development is going on. We've got a blog that we're bringing up now. It was kind of dormant for a little bit, and we'll start writing more specific stories, more specific things. A lot of the team leaders can be found right there, myself included, and you can just click on a link and get emailed to us. And it's a really exciting time to get involved. There's a lot going on right now. We're doing a lot of engine testing. We're bringing up a new educational program. We're trying to build curriculum and projects for teachers and students alike. We're writing a novel. We've got a Hugo Award-winning, New York Times best-selling military sci-fi author involved in writing a novel and short story anthology. We're just trying, again, to bring up that public awareness and to show people what we've got going on.
When you say Open Luna, does that mean that people can contribute, like through open source? Is that available for informed listeners to be able to do that?
It is. Informed listeners can download what we have, look at what we're working on, ask questions for what's not on the site, but you know, it looks like we have some information. Like right now, there's not a lot on the lander, not a lot on the suit, but they have some significant development. They can ask questions about that, and then we'll get that information out on the wiki. They can look at it. They can say, you know, this might work better if you did this. Or even for those who aren't technically minded, they can look at the mission and say, you know, this part really strikes me. I'd like to draw this picture. I'd like to write a song about this. I want to participate in some way. Can I tell my high school class about it? We're holding a couple of contests. Like, we just announced our two contests for our rovers. And, you know, high school students, college students can come to the website, come to the wiki and say, hey, I want to participate. You know, what are the rules? We're actually opening the rules. You know, in our open source nature, we're actually opening the rules for the contest up for, I don't know, manipulation, adjustment by the team members. Of course, there will be a vetting because there are certain minimums that we have to make our mission work. And if we don't hit those minimums, then it doesn't mean anything to us. The science team has given us certain guidelines that we have to hit. But anything around that, like certain things, like when is it okay to replace something that's space qualified that only works in space with something that's usable on Earth?
Go ahead.
Get everybody involved. That's the big thing. We're trying to get as many people as possible involved because it's an exciting time. And how many people get a real chance to work on a real space mission, much less a lunar mission. It's really a unique opportunity, and we want as many people as possible to take advantage of it. I want to hear from some 12-year-old girl in Uganda who's gone out to the website and wants a piece, you know, she wants to learn how to do even algebra. And she doesn't have an instructor. We'll find coursework for her, or we'll have it made. If they want to draw, you know, somebody from wherever wants to draw an image that they think is beautiful for the project, then they can draw it, send it to us. They can mail it, or they can scan it and fire it up on the wiki.
Do you?
And then we've got the engine test. We've got real fire. We're actually bending metal. We're making material. We've got flight-worthy hardware. That's one of the things that you saw here. I mean, we had our very, very, very first generation lander, crude as anything you've ever seen, and yet it still flew. Is that something anybody could build in the basement?
Was there a lot of interest in your exhibit and talking to you from the? What do you call it, the people at the conference? Did you get a lot of stop-bys of your booth?
We did. The conference and the attendees were very excited about it, especially since we brought out that Mark I spec lander. They were very excited about it. We had people there pretty much continuously. Whenever there were people in the hallways, there was somebody in front of our table, somebody looking at the lander, someone talking to us, looking at the, you know, we just... new brochures, had that out. All of those things, you know, it was pretty continuous. We were pretty excited about the feedback we were getting, about the people seeing what was going on and what they wanted to do to help. And, you know, something else that anybody can do, just to add to the everything list, all of the marketing materials we use, the posters we have, the brochures we have, postcards, all of those are at some point available on the website so that local, you know, if you have your high school group or your college group and you want to get involved in a meaningful way, you can download this material and talk to Debbie Lee. She's in charge of, she's our VP of resources, and we consider people to be critical resources. And start a chapter somewhere, and we will support that. And you can start by looking at the material and giving it to somebody who you think might be interested.
So, again, if people want to get in touch with you or follow up with you, how's the best way to do that?
OpenLuna.org.
Is your email there for you too? Can they reach you that way through your email as well?
My email is there. It's on that website, but I'll just tell you, it's paul@openluna.org.
Okay.
If you want to get a hold of me, paul@openluna.org. Go to the website, openluna.org. We're rearranging servers right now, so expect some changes, lots of changes in the very near future. We've got a whole new rack of data that we're firing up to the wiki right now. Basically, as soon as I get back to NewSpace, I'm going to be filling up a lot of it right now. Come take a look. It's a lot of fun. We've got a lot of good things going on. I'm excited with what's in the future.
Interesting. So, listeners, if you want to find out more, check them out, OpenLuna, and it's luna.org.
Correct.
Are you going to be someplace else where people might be able to see some of your hardware and talk to you in person?
Well, we'll be at Space Vision. We'll be at the SED conference in Buffalo. There is a space happening. I don't have all the details in Atlanta. We'll be there. I'll be wandering around DragonCon, but we won't have any hardware there. I'll be at ISDC. We'll be at New Space next year. Well, actually, let's just say there's going to be a really interesting demonstration at ISDC and New Space next year. I think people will be excited, and they should definitely come and see us.
They
should be involved before that.
As I understand it, ISDC is in San Diego, right?
Right.
And I don't have any information on New Space 2013, but I'm assuming because of the business plan growth, it'll be back in the Silicon Valley area around the same time it was this year. But I haven't seen any data on that yet.
I haven't either, but we've already made arrangements with the Space Frontier Foundation, and they want us back, and they definitely want to showcase what we've got going on here, and we're certainly certainly excited to provide us a good show.
I was looking for that technical engineering blog that I told you about at the conference, and
yes.
I was hoping to be able to have had the time to find it and announce it over the air, but it doesn't look like I'm going to be able to find it in sufficient time, so I'll have to email it to you. But I haven't forgotten it.
As busy as you were this conference, I'm surprised you found time to sleep.
Especially
you were just a flurry of activity this weekend.
Yeah, especially making the mistake of commuting back and forth from the. Okay, here I found it. You know, because I chose not to stay at the hotel, and I thought, I'm only an hour or so away from Silicon Valley, but it didn't work that way with traffic, baseball games, going there by 8 o'clock in the morning with commute hours, and the damn thing was so much fun. I didn't get out of there till 10 o'clock at night, so I wasn't getting home till midnight. I should have just been able to go upstairs to the hotel. Here we go.
That's why I always stay at conference hotels. You know, new space, they always throw the best out for parties.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and you know, the networking and the fun is endless. Plus, that hotel had a lot going on in the lobby. With they had a science fiction convention going on, and you know, they had a meeting of Latter-day Saints, and the place was packed, and they had a couple of other pretty interesting things going on. There were a lot of people to meet if you wanted to just go out and meet general people. Here it is. It's called NASASpaceflight.com, NASASpaceflight.com. And that is what the direct team did, and posted a lot of their designs and stuff when they were fighting for the direct launcher before President Obama was elected and killed Constellation, and they were hoping direct would be a viable option to Constellation. And they were on the show a lot, and they kept talking about getting engineering critiques and reviews and stuff from people on that kind of blog. So again, it's NASASpaceflight.com.
I'm looking forward to
check it out.
Some of our information up to them and getting embedded by some of the people who are, well, this is what they do every day, all day.
Let's see. I guess that's it. So we'll clear the line and we'll let other people call in, and thanks a lot, okay? And I'll probably see you at ISDC or New Space next year.
I look forward to meeting you again. I appreciate the time on the show.
Bye-bye. Listeners, you're welcome to call the toll-free line. I know there's a three-minute lag from when I say something on air to when you hear it, or about a three-minute, depending on which streaming service you're listening to. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. I really enjoyed the New Space Conference. It is really becoming far more professional, credible. And I think if you go to the Space Vidicast website and you see the archived segments of the conference, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on it, I bet that many of you will agree with me. I mean, there were some fun sessions. The session yesterday morning with Rick Tumlinson early, people were kidding around and referring to Rick as Reverend Rick, and that's probably like the church going service of the conference. But it wasn't like that for most of it. But it was, you know, I listened to that driving down to the conference. I had it on my iPhone and was listening because I couldn't get down there by 8 o'clock in the morning, so I didn't get to see the video part of it. You know, the actual. You know, visuals, but I did hear it all, and that was fun. I mean, I don't know anything else to say. So again, for those of you who would like to call us, it is 1-866-687-7223. If you have any questions about the conference or anything else that's going on in the space community, and there, you know, there is some news about space. There are things that are happening out there. With satellites and with the progress going to the space station, and with we're still waiting for down select, as you know, for the new CCDEV program. So, you know, that hasn't occurred yet. I think they're late on that, and hopefully we'll get some word on that. Sierra Nevada and Dream Chaser was represented well at the conference, and Mark Sorangelo was a keynote speaker on one of the conference days at lunch. very, very informative. Good talk. And here is our call coming in. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Yes, this is Doug Spahn. I'm listening.
Okay, you need to kill your computer or I hang up on you.
Oh, I'm okay, hold on. Let me do that. Okay, there we go.
Okay, because the feedback is unbearable.
Oh, yeah, that could be very difficult.
Go for it.
I'm Doug. I'm a physician from Southern California. And actually, NewSpace 2012 was my first space conference. It was a total blast. I just enjoyed every moment of it. David, when you and I, we met, we spoke a little bit, if you recall.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, I mentioned about the lunar cost petition, which I started. You suggested I call in and just sort of share with your listeners about that petition.
Yeah, go ahead. It's at lunarcots.com, if I recall.
That is correct. So, basically, I think that there's a fairly broad agreement among a lot of space advocates that this NASA commercial partnership of COTS, CRS, and CCDEV have been fairly successful, and these programs are really increasing America's commercial access to low-Earth orbit, including manned access. So the concept behind Lunar COTS is simply to say, you know, why stop there? After CCDEV is completed, wouldn't the next logical step be to extend this new commercial approach throughout cislunar space, including the resources of the lunar surface, such as the poles? So that's the concept behind the lunar cost petition. Could I just take 40 seconds and read the text of the lunar cost petition?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. It says, we, the undersigned, urge the establishment of space act agreements programs for the commercial development of cislunar space, including cislunar transportation, lunar surface equipment, harvesting of lunar polar ice, LEO and Lagrangian fuel depots, a small manned lunar base to support mining operations. Specifically, we urge the establishment of the following program: commercial lunar cargo, commercial lunar crew, commercial cislunar supply service. We believe that these programs will serve the needs of NASA and the Defense Department, serve and expand commercial markets, and permanently and economically open up the solar system to human settlement. We believe that the recent cost-effective and ongoing successes of NASA's commercial programs have validated these private-public ventures, and so give good reason to extend this approach so that the moon becomes included in our economic sphere. So again, that's lunarcost.com, and I had the petition there at NewSpace 2012 conference. I think it was generally well received. I was even able to share the concept with a couple of the NASA policy people there. And both of them were highly supportive. Because they were on NASA time, they felt like they couldn't actually sign it. But I was told that, you know, on private time, that they are free to sign it if they so chose. So I hope to follow up on that.
Did you find people signing the petition at the conference?
Yes, I got a number of signatures. I didn't have a booth or anything, so it was just, you know, on private conversations, and I'd ask them if they wanted to sign it.
So how does this differ from, well, let me rephrase it. You want a petition about developing cislunar space and transportation, and you want to use Space Act agreements, right?
That is correct.
Okay, and the programs that I have done on cislunar development, for the most part, are developing with private companies, like what Dr. Spudas talks about, the upcoming program on the 6th with Dennis Wingo, per his blog article. We'll talk about that. So where is the role, or how do you see the government getting involved where we need Space Act agreements, or for that matter, any agreement with these guys?
Sure. Well, my sense is I think that we ought to be pushing in different directions. I know at one point Paul Spudas was really recommending full funding of the Spudas LaVoy plan by government. And I'm not familiar if he is now talking, you know, just strictly commercial, but there's this hybrid approach that, you know, seems like it's a successful approach. If there is a lunar cost, you know, through FAA funding. If that becomes available, my sense is that really helps the commercial companies be able to raise private capital because, for example, part of the agreement would probably be that NASA would purchase a certain amount of product, you know, water or cryogenic fuel delivered to either L1 Depot or LEO Depot. And so if we get lunar costs established, I think it's going to greatly help commercial companies to set this up. If we don't get it, well, then we keep pushing in strictly commercial direction. That's my view.
So, listeners, if you're interested in learning more, what's the website again?
LunarCost.com.
Is there a timeline for when you need to do this?
I haven't set a timeline. I'll see how it goes. I think I need to be proactive in reaching out to people, to, you know, emailing them, letting them know about the position. So we'll see how it goes. And then at some point in time, I'll say, you know, a certain number of signatures or a certain amount of time, and then go to the next step, and that is actually begin sharing this with Congress, with NASA administrators, and with the administration itself. We need to develop, you know, get enough signatures before we do that stuff.
Did you talk to the gentleman at the conference who was also giving a big talk yesterday, was on one of the panels, from Shackleton Energy and about their lunar economic development plans?
I was at when Eric Anderson spoke at lunch. I was at the...
That was another one, yeah. Did any of them sign the petition?
No, I didn't get the opportunity, actually. But I want to follow up with him. I got his card, so I'd like to follow up with him and see if he's interested in that.
Yeah, listeners, Eric Anderson of Planetary Resources gave a keynote. I think the keynotes were also recorded and archived and streamed live, but I'm not 100% sure about that. But Eric's talk was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And if it is archived there on the Space Bitacast archives, it's a keynote luncheon talk you want to see. And also the one by Mark Sarangelo the day before at Sierra Nevada and Dream Chaser. But I just don't know if the luncheon talks were streamed live or archived. Do you know if they were, like the regular conference programming?
I don't know. I'm sorry. I looked around to see. I saw somebody holding up a iPhone and recording it, but I don't recall seeing, you know, professional video there.
Now, you're in Riverside County, right?
Really San Bernardino, but close to Riverside.
Well, you probably haven't seen, or maybe you have, but yesterday the New York Times did an investigative story. This has nothing to do with space, but it just reminded me that you're in the area, of critical doctor shortages in Riverside, San Bernardino, as the lead counties in America that are really facing a huge medical crisis as a result of a whole bunch of factors with the new healthcare law. And they cited Riverside and San Bernardino in their analysis as the, I don't know what you would say, the guide dogs for the rest of the country or whatever. So if you haven't seen that New York Times article, since it strikes home in your doctor in that area, you might want to see it. My experience with the New York Times is that it's hit and miss for accuracy. So I have no way to do any due diligence on what they're saying about the area or not. But I just thought I'd point it out to you in case you haven't seen it.
I'll look it up. Obviously, I'm very interested in that. I think Southern California is in a particularly difficult situation. You probably know San Bernardino City itself, you know, rather large city, I don't know, 300,000 people filed bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And just our being in California, number one, also just being so close to the border and the demands that it places on services.
Well, yeah, they talk about the phenomenal growth that the area has had in population and an influx of people, and they said, you know, everything's being taxed, but this was specifically about their medical community.
And several years ago, I remember hearing that San Bernardino City was actually the highest welfare percentage of the population. So it's just a very difficult, I don't know how we're going to survive economically. It's very challenging.
Well, a lot of people are wondering the same thing.
Yeah.
not just in Riverside and San Bernardino. Anyway, listen, it was fun meeting you at the conference. I hope we have a chance to meet again. I'm often in the Hollywood area because that's where my son lives, and I go down to conferences. Like, I'll be at AIAA in Pasadena, which is in early September. I would like to say I'm not that far from you, but by the crow flies, yeah, that's true. By the way the traffic moves,
yeah,
well, might as well be in New York, right?
I make it out to Pasadena periodically, so it's not that far.
Well, I don't know if you're planning to attend, but the AIAA conference called Space 2012, but possibly when I'm down there we can get together for lunch or something, or meet in between or do something, but it'd be fun to catch up with you again.
That would be nice. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling in, and it was great meeting you at the conference.
Likewise.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Listener, that clears our toll-free for others to call. You know how many people came up to me and said, I listen to the Space Show. I've been listening for 5 years. And my standard reply is, why don't you call in? That's what I said to every single one of them. Where are you? Why don't you call in and participate in the show? Well, I usually listen by archives. And I said, okay. You know, you can send in advanced emails because I think you get the newsletter. And if you know you're going to listen on archives and yet you'd like to ask the guest a question, send in an advanced email. I read them on air all the time. I didn't know we could do that, so that's my fault, listeners. So, yes, you can send in an email in advance of any show, of any guest, and as long as it's not too long, I'll read it on air. And if you send it in early enough and it's too long, I'll ask you to consolidate it. But please, yeah, send in your emails. If you know you can't listen to a live show, you're at work, you're traveling, or you do archives to play them while you're exercising or something like that, that's cool. But you want to talk to one of the guests, send in your note ahead of time, and we do that all the time. I need to incorporate that as a standard announcement on the Space Show. We have another caller with us. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is Tim from Huntsville.
Welcome. How are you? You weren't at the New Space Conference. Shame on you.
I got a job, and
hey.
I don't really make enough money for it.
Well, just quit your job. Be a first-time unemployment statistic. It's all for being, for furthering space. You know, you got to do your part to further space, and then come out to these conferences.
No, sorry, I can't do that.
I've been trying to.
I don't want to burden my own family, with being unemployed and not working, because
a lot of
I don't work, those are the only people I can come to.
A lot of people at the conferences are out of work. They come there looking for aerospace engineering and related jobs when they know there are companies such as ATK and Loral and Sierra Nevada are there, because, a lot of times at these conferences, people do get jobs and they do find investment opportunities. And at SmallSat, Tim, which you hear me talk about ad nauseum on this show because I like the conference so much, I've never seen as much recruiting going on as at the SmallSat conference. If I had any kind of aerospace-related or engineering-related degree and I were 30 to 40 years younger, SmallSat would be the place I would go with a million copies of my resume, a clean haircut. I'd get rid of all the tattoos on my body. And, I'd be interviewing nonstop, 8 to 5 p.m. in the day, for one of these high-paying, really cool jobs with commercial space companies. That is really the place to go. But that isn't why you called in. So what's happening?
Okay, here's the deal. All right, there's apparently for anyone that's not familiar with Title IX. Title IX was something that was started in the 1970s to address discrimination against women. In any time that a school takes money from the government, they have to they cannot discriminate against people because of their gender.
Well, it's in sports and athletics, right? Mostly.
That's how it's applied. Yes, mostly. And it's done terrible things to it, because a lot of schools had to close down. A lot of the sports programs, athletic programs, because of Title IX. Simply put it, there's more men in sports than there are women. but they put this quota on them anyway. It's almost as though the government is actually punishing colleges for, you know, career decisions made by women.
But I do know women who went to UCLA and other schools out here on Title IX scholarships in sports, that would not have been possible had Title IX not been implemented 3 or 4 decades ago.
True, but I think about all the men that lose their scholarships because of Title IX. And here, this is the problem with Title IX. Title IX goes beyond simply, attacking overt actions of discrimination, like, we don't want you, you're a woman, get out. Title IX covers that, but then it puts quotas saying that, well, if you don't have enough women in a certain program, you are discriminating against them, irregardless of whether those women want to be in there or not. And what I'm calling about is that Title IX is being applied to STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. They say that 17% of engineers and 18% of computer science-related bachelor's degrees in 2009 to 2010 was awarded to women.
So what is it going to do? So STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math, and space is in part of that. So what does that do? Pick a country, a company. Okay, University of Alabama in Huntsville has a terrific aerospace engineering program. We all know that's one of the best in the world. So what does that do with the school in Huntsville and their aerospace engineering program, for example?
Well, we can surmise what would happen based on what happened in other programs. I'll give you look at it may not happen to UAH, because it's got a pretty good engineering program. It is an engineering school. But with schools, other colleges where engineering is secondary to their other courses, they may close it down if they can't meet Title IX standards.
So why would they close it down? I mean, I'm not understanding why they would close a program down.
Because they can't get enough women into it.
But the men are still in the program, so why would they close it down?
Oh, well, to avoid any sort of litigation purposes.
That's okay, so I'm being dumb here on purpose.
They can be sued or face penalties by the government if they're not Title IX compliant. If somebody
okay,
compliant.
So let's say the aerospace engineering department has 25 graduate students in it and 21 undergrads in it. And as typical engineering would be, it's 92% men, both at the undergraduate and graduate level. Does that sound about right?
Maybe a little too high, but yeah,
80 or 90%. Okay, 85% men. Okay, so now what would Title IX do to that mix? Let's say 85% men in the undergraduate program and 88% men in the graduate program. What does Title IX applied to engineering require them to do with that mix?
It may require them to, since the school can't make women go into engineering courses.
Yeah, nobody can, right.
They may say, we're going to keep men from going into it because we can't get, well, there's two ways they can get their numbers up. Either get more women in it or get less men into it.
They can't put
a gun up to a woman's head and say, go take an engineering course because we got full quota. But they can say, no, you can't be in our engineering program, sir, because we got too many men and not enough women.
Okay, so what you're saying it does is it imposes a quota on the engineering department in this example so that the mix, and I'm just being arbitrary because I have no clue what the quota would be, so it can be no more than 71% men. So that means in order to meet that quota, you either have to have women's enrollment skyrocket in the department or you have to remove men from the department so that whatever number of women are in it, eventually their percentage of the total meets that 29% that I'm using as an example.
That's correct.
And now, is this already law and in effect, or is this a proposal?
It looks like it's already in effect because the way the law is written, it's pretty much up to the executive branch on how to enforce it. It's almost like they got a blank check to extend the law or to, you know, to how they can enforce it.
Okay. I'm wondering, you probably don't know, but does anyone out there know, say the gender mix in Chinese educational systems for engineering? Because when I go to various companies and meet people, I meet an awful lot of women engineers from China. I mean, I meet a lot of men, too. The same thing with India. So I'm wondering, you know, if Title IX is trying to imitate or equalize us with, say, what goes on in Asia, or are we trying to do something totally artificial here?
It's totally artificial. I mean, if you really want more women into STEM, you have to start early. Get my preschool or K, get them more interested in science or technology. I'll be honest with you. I think there are also certain differences between men and women, that women tend to gravitate towards certain occupations more so than men and vice versa. But, you know, even so, if you start them off young, getting them interested in math and science, then they'll eventually, those numbers will even out more. But you can't take somebody, a young lady that's going to college and they're going to college to be a nurse or be a teacher, and then tell them, wouldn't it be fun if you became an engineer?
Well,
they
get scholarships into those divisions, right?
Oh, they can, but you know they have to show amount of interest in it. They have to show. Also, these are also kind of math heavy, and math is looked down upon by, you know. You know how young people are when they go to school. They sort of frown upon any sort of student that shows they're nerds because they're really good at math or something, right?
Yeah, but I have to tell you, Tim, in my North Dakota class, I mean, they're predominantly men, but it depends on the class. Some of them have a very strong percentage of women, and the women are from the finest engineering schools in the country. And I go to these conferences. I go to SpaceX. You know, I've been to other companies, and incredible women doing engineering and building the rockets and working on systems. So I don't really see what you're talking about. At the New Space Conference, they had NASA people on panels and stuff like that all come out of the engineering department and many of the companies, ATK and stuff, all women. So I don't know, maybe I don't see the need for Title IX in STEM because I see such a strong engineering presence and science presence of women. The woman who presented the business plan on the radiation mitigation pill that I told you about is a PhD in molecular science. She has a specialty in anthrax. The team that I coached has a younger member of the team, and most of the others have years of experience with Aerojet and other companies. You know, they're more or less my age, give or take a few years. But one of the team members is a young aerospace engineer woman up in Reno, Nevada, who's helping to deal with these propulsion fuels and on and off starters and stuff like that. And I could go through the teams of the other business plans, and I mean they're predominantly men, yes. But everybody I met has female representation.
Oh.
What they don't have is a lot of foreign representation, and that has a lot to do with ITAR issues. You know, and most of these businesses are dealing in in ITAR regulated businesses and materials and stuff like that. I just see the presence of women in engineering as growing by leaps and bounds when I go to these companies and when I teach at North Dakota and when I go to these conferences. So, again, maybe I'm missing the boat and I don't see the need for something like Title IX because I see the women already excelling and doing amazing things. I just don't know.
I'll be honest with you. I honestly think some of this is election year pandering to the base. And also, you know, if we were living in an alternate reality where, 90% of women were in STEM, I wouldn't mind. I wouldn't mind at all. You know, the only thing, the only problem I have is, you know, the government coming down on these colleges and artificially setting a certain standard by setting a certain ratio between men and women in STEM. That's my major problem more than anything.
Listeners, if you're interested in this and you want to know more, I guess you can Google Title IX and STEM. Here's a note from Doug, and he's the guy who just called, who's a doctor in Riverside in San Bernardino, who we were just talking to, who has the lunar petition. He says, I'd just like to point out that the first woman stepping out onto the moon would probably be watched by 5 billion people, including 80% of the girls. That one event could inspire a very large number of girls to pursue STEM careers. And I absolutely agree with you, Doug, and it would do far more for motivating women to go into the sciences if that's a public policy goal than any kind of government decree like Title IX or this or that or something else. Also, Sally Ride, who recently passed away, that was a real loss for our community. And Mark Sarangelo made a very moving and respectful and appropriate tribute to her in his luncheon keynote that I described a few minutes ago. It was very, very good, and we all were appreciative of Mark doing that. But Sally had an outreach foundation in the San Diego area geared for getting women and people involved in STEM and engineering and these kinds of science related programs. And my understanding is that work continues because it was a foundation and it will continue on. And she was doing fabulous work and making progress in that. So I don't know. I mean, I see a lot of efforts from women who have accomplished a lot, and they're giving it back to the community. You know, listeners know I'm kind of a smaller government kind of guy, so I'm not always of the opinion that government decrees work as well as what people who have the experience and the knowledge and the know-how and the burning passion have and can give back to the community. But again, listeners, Tim raises an interesting point. I've read the articles about it. I know what he's talking about. And if you're interested, Google STEM, STEM, and Title IX. And if you agree or disagree, maybe it's time you let your members of Congress know. I don't know what else to say. I mean, it's election time. Maybe they'll actually pay attention to a letter or an email or a fax that you send them for a change. I don't know. But I don't know anything else to suggest. Do you?
Like you said, you know, you do more by inspiring than mandating.
I think so, and I appreciate the email from Doug, and who made that point. And Sally Ride certainly thought so. She wasn't out there trying to get the government to mandate anything. She did it through a private foundation and was very, very successful with it. Okay, Tim, thanks for calling in. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Listeners, again, if this is a subject that interests you, boy, the phone's ringing again. Go for it. Look it up. See what you can find out about it. Hi, caller. Who are you?
Charles.
Welcome, Mr. Pooley. You missed a doozy of a conference. This is where your micro-launcher's business plan could have possibly walked away with $100,000.
Well, yeah, if I won it, but the deal is I have to be careful about investing in advance before I get some kind of results going. So I basically can't afford trips for a while.
Well, this is just a trip to the Bay Area. Come on, it's a 10-hour drive.
It would be a major problem with me. And then, of course, I would have to rent a hotel room and so on.
Well, you live on the street with all the other homeless bums that are out here.
No, I'm not ready to do that. I'm okay here in Las Vegas and beginning to make some traction and progress.
Paul Breed had his business plan and presented. It was very interesting. Unfortunately, it didn't win anything. Paul will be up at SmallSat again, and I look forward to seeing him.
He's better than I am. He can afford to go. I cannot at the present time. But will, as soon as I reach some kind of a critical mass of directly involved people locally, then I will start going to these things.
All right. There were a lot of CubeSat business plans presented, you know, making use of CubeSats and programs.
I suspect all of these business plans simply skip over the launch problem, probably presume secondary payload launches.
Secondary payloads
is not going to get things going. That was the core idea of micro-launchers, that it includes launch means as the basis.
Well, Paul Breed, his plan was for a CubeSat launching company off the ocean, in the ocean.
Yeah, well,
he was the only one that wasn't talking about secondary payload rides.
Okay, well, then he's the only one besides me. I've been talking about a vertically integrated launcher and payload system for over 15 years, and then as soon as a vertically integrated system works, the payloads at least will become open source right away. But the launcher itself, because of regulations, cannot right away become open source.
Well, I'll see if I can get Paul back on after SmallSat ends and
say hello to him
and call in.
And
he looks great. He's lost a ton of weight. He looks absolutely great. And he told me his diet secrets, and I effectively started this morning. And Rand Simberg was there too, and he also looks terrific. And they're doing pretty similar things. So, listeners, maybe in 6 months you won't hear me bitch about being overweight anymore. So we'll see.
I was on Paul's Lunar Lander Challenge team.
Yeah, no, I know, and I know you're friends, and you guys know each other. So,
no,
Paul's a first class guy. He's my rocket equation, technical engineering, realistic, no holes bar, terrific guy.
I am too. I'm dealing with rockets as they really are and really work.
Yeah, but you know the rocket equation can be bent. We all know that. You know you can bend.
No,
the loss
you really
of physics.
Can't bend it. Come on, it's physics.
Okay, what are you calling for,
okay,
Charles?
I want to stir up some crap again about this mysterious nanosatellite challenge. It's the latest of the series of NASA challenges, of which, remember, the Lunar Lander Challenge, where three people got hardware flying. Paul Breed was unfortunately the one who did not win any cash. John Carmack and Mastin divided the
right. They won the pot, yeah.
And that ran from mid 06 to October 09, ran its course. A lot of stuff got done. There was a lot of excitement and publicity. There were about a dozen intended entrants to it, but like I say, only three got hardware off the ground. However, one of the follow-ons is the NanoSat Challenge, and there's a total of $3 million in prizes for this, and the basic accomplishment is to put at least 1 kilo satellite into orbit, making at least one orbit twice within 1 week. And for some reason, this is not getting off the ground, pun intended. NASA first announced it in July of 10, and they had trouble finding an allied organization to administer the prize. The prize money is only for prizes. And then an organization has to be found to administer the prize using funds that they raise separately. And NASA couldn't get until November of last year an outfit called spaceflorida.gov. And the use of that gov domain is peculiar to me because, well, whatever. Anyway, this outfit has then been moving very, very slowly. On their website, they were to have had weekly updates of people making comments about the proposed rules. And the last weekly update was July 6th. And they have a forum at the bottom of their homepage The last posting on the forum was July 7th. I was then, there's a total of only four posts with three replies. I made the first posting 2 days after the thing opened on the 23rd. And the thing is like dead in the water, and I don't know what's going on here. This is very strange because the overall, the NASA Challenge thing has produced results. And this one is, I don't know. It's very strange. And if anybody knows or is curious, okay. They have a mailing list of about 80 people that have signed up for updates and so on. And I know about seven of the people.
Well, this is about the third or fourth time you've put this out there. Nobody's even bothered
to
ever comment.
That is really strange.
I didn't hear it mentioned one time during the 3.5 days I was at NewSpace.
That is strange.
And there was no shortage of the use of the word CubeSat, NanoSat, under any circumstance. I mean, that was like the trend of the future, and not one word about any of this.
And the reason I'm interested in this is I was counting on publicity surrounding it to help attract team members to join with me on this. And then I was going to, I've already incorporated Microlaunchers, it's an LLC now, and organize a production run of about 100 launchers, the balance of them to be offered as a CubeSat launch service. Because there is now no way to get CubeSats up except occasional secondary payloads. And here, with a dedicated launcher,
well, the military program, the government program out of New Mexico that I've talked about on the air, is finding rides for CubeSats all the time.
All the time, defined all the time, like every week?
Well, their goal is that they're flying the student payloads while the students are still students.
As secondary payloads.
Yeah, they're all it's all secondary payloads.
Well,
Charles.
Except microlaunchers won't be.
But you're in theory. They're finding real rides for these guys as we speak, and they will be back up in force at SmallSat. Now they've been defunded in the fiscal year 13 budget, so it'll be interesting to see how all this shapes up in the future.
Secondary payloads is, I think, a highly uncertain proposition, and the whole idea behind microlaunchers was to be able to produce launchers by the hundreds, then thousands, whatever the market will bear, and have a fairly short waiting period for launch. And the core purpose of the microlaunchers was to send very small spacecraft, 100 to 200 grams, to escape, because that's where space exploration begins.
So just to reaffirm something that you're saying, and the companies that had the use of CubeSats in their business plans, and they were all going up on secondary payloads.
Yeah.
I mean that's a given.
Yeah.
The judges, and if you all go and watch the video presentation of this from the conference, almost to a plan, part of the questioning was, what are your contingency plans for launch delay? What are your plans if the orbits that you're going to be able to access as a secondary payload are not your desirable orbits? I didn't hear anybody mention the fact, and I learned this at SmallSat last year with Dr. Perry Ballard, and he said the same thing when he was back on the show, unless I'm misunderstanding him, that CubeSats, you require permission from some CubeSat authority, I don't know what it is, as to what orbits you're allowed to go to and when, because they don't typically have station keeping and they do decay, and you may not be able to launch your CubeSat to where you want it to go depending on what else may be in that orbit or what else is planned. So if you want to go to 600 kilometers and you want to stay up there for 2 years, for example, they may say, 300 kilometers, 3 months.
Yes.
Take it or leave it. And none of the business plans addressed that kind of it's not a government regulatory thing. It's an industry regulatory system to protect the integrity of orbits.
Well, here's the deal. I think there is a space sickness. The space sickness being a mindset that locks onto end result with little attention paid to how you get there. For example, the Google Lunar X Prize, when they first opened in 07, they had a forum. The forum was full of discussions, all about rovers, nothing at all about means to get there, to the moon. It's a disease. People, their minds have been blinded to everything but dreams of end result. And people have to overcome that. That's what Microlaunches is about. Microlaunches is an attempt to build a vertically integrated system which rises off the ground and delivers payloads and tiny ones so that they're less expensive. And people aren't getting it. And it's a disease.
Well, there's no shortage of interest and business ideas and creative use of CubeSats.
And nothing's going to happen until means to get there is developed. And that's what I've been working on for quite a few years. And most people don't even get the concept. I figure 1% of people who hear a brief microlauncher pitch get the idea. In other words, understand the premise. And what I'm looking for is out of that 1%, maybe 1 in 1,000 like the idea enough to want to join up and get involved. So I was hoping the nanosatellite challenge thing would catalyze interest. But I am amazed and disappointed, and I really don't know what the hell's going on here.
Did you email Space Florida?
Well, I'm on their list. I met the guy, let's see, what's his name? It escapes me a minute, the guy's name. He was at the Space Access Society meeting in Phoenix last April. I met him, gave him a business card, talked to him briefly, and so on. And then shortly after that, the preliminary rules were posted from Florida. And I don't know. But, yeah, I may contact him directly to his own personal email, bypassing the website, because the website appears dead. Although, maybe I will, as a test, put up a new posting on the forum. I have a feeling it'll appear there, and it will be the fifth one.
Well, we have another open lines planned later in August, so if you have more information. But it's interesting that I'm not...
I'll just ping you with...
Yeah, but it's interesting. We don't even get any comments on this on the Space Show blog. It's as if the Space Show listeners don't care about it either.
Something has fallen through a hole in the floor. Because ordinarily the NASA challenge series gets some traction and people get into it. But this one is strange. And the first thing that struck me weird was that NASA took an extra year in finding an organization to run it. The other two that started the same year, one had to do with an automated rover thing that would retrieve samples autonomously. And I think another one had to do with a rover that could run overnight or do something like that. Anyway, those are going ahead.
All right. Let me clear the line, and I got to take a break.
Thanks for listening.
And thanks, Charles.
I don't know what's going on, and please, if anybody hears or has ideas, email me or whatever at microlaunches.com and
all right.
So on.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Listeners, we're going to a break. This show is going to end at about 2 o'clock my time. So if you... you know, if you want to get your call in, you've got roughly 45 minutes, okay? We're on break for a couple of minutes, and we'll be right back.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Open Lines on the Space Show. We do have a caller on hold, which I'll get to in a second. Our toll-free number is 866-687-7223. And email is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we have about 45 minutes left in our program today. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is Jerry Everett in Merritt Island, Florida.
Ah, howdy, Jerry. How you doing?
Okay, how are you doing?
Well, a little tired after all my driving back and forth to Santa Clara, but I really did. I was really impressed with the quality of New Space this year. You've heard me talking about it for the past hour or so, but great business plans. We'll be talking about more of them and having them on the show, and really a much more professional oriented conference. I hope a lot of you will just go and watch some of the archived segments from the conference.
Yeah, I watched the live stream, and then I've been watching or looking into it.
Did you hear Rick's Let's Go to Church meeting yesterday morning?
No, I haven't seen that yet. I haven't gotten through all of them.
I agree
with the tenor of the conference. I much prefer this one to any of the prior. Less hoo-ha and pseudo-religious attachment to things.
Oh, well, then what
much more respectful of space
Okay. Jerry, you got to hear Rick's program yesterday morning. He's got church music playing in the background, and he's preaching that this is our religion. This is, you know, if you think New Space is a religion, and you go by this hour with Rick yesterday morning with the church music blaring, oh my God.
I'm a Roman Catholic, so I've already got my color.
You got to just have fun with this. I mean, I love Rick to death, and he's a very inspiring speaker, but this is the most over-the-top admission of New Space as a religion and a cult you will ever hear in your life. And, you know, everybody was kidding afterwards, Reverend Rick, this, that, and the other, and I don't know that it was I guess I could say it really wasn't representative of the conference, but you got to hear it. I mean,
I got the impression anyway there was a mindset change.
Oh yeah, except for this one session.
Actually, executing with the hardware, you know, it's all of a sudden old space and NASA get a lot smarter than they were last year.
Oh yeah, but you got to hear. The come to religion with Rick and the church music. This is classic, and I'm going to get a lot of mileage out of it. That's about all I can tell you. I'm really going to milk it to the nth degree for fun.
I really enjoyed the business presentation.
Yeah, some of them were incredible, weren't they?
Yeah, I wish I had been there just for one question to the ARLIP 76 folks. Which is, you know, I really like their presentation. I think their product has some real potential, more really outside aerospace than in. But, you know, one thing that I didn't hear mentioned, and maybe they had it in their business plan and I just don't have access to it, but there are two drugs out there that were shown to be effective with the Fukushima disaster. They gave mice lethal radiation doses. And 40 to 80% of them survived on either the thrombomodulin or the protein C. And those are both drugs that are already approved by the...
She addressed this in the coaching, because we ask about competition and stuff like that. And, you know, when she comes on the show, if she comes on, or their CEO may come on, you'll get a much better answer than me. But apparently this is a naturally occurring protein in the body. So the mechanism for it working without side effects, as to what they say, is very different from the drugs that you mentioned. And that it also does stuff regarding cell damage, and it has a broader range of what it can work on in terms of radiation than, say, what was happening with Fukushima. But she did answer, at least in the coaching session, because we ask her questions about that, as to how her product would differ from what's already out there. I don't think that was asked by any of the business plan judges. But I also think NASA was really interested in the project. So we wait and see. I don't know what else to see.
Yeah, I think the thing about it, all of these drugs, is it's going to take years of clinical trials before any of these things can really be thought to be safe and effective for as anti-radiation therapy. That said, the market for them is huge. The major market would be people who are undergoing radiation for bone marrow transplants or HIV therapy, where you're destroying bone marrow and you're worried about radiation effects killing people. And if you could give people prophylactic doses of this before you did the irradiation, you would save a whole lot of people's lives.
She did talk about an oncology usage, and the other thing she did say again during the coaching, and then I asked her privately over drinks later in the hotel at the bar, that number one, it cannot restore or repair damage. So if you already have cellular damage, you're not going to get back to before the damage happened. And I asked her if it could have saved that British guy who was given that poison, remember, by the Russians to kill him about 5 years ago. Do you remember?
Yeah, no, because that was an ongoing situation that was never going to leave his body.
And
bury him in a lead coffin.
Yeah, and she said it took too long to figure out what was happening to the guy. The damage was already in place and done, and it was likely at such high levels and so intense that you could not have stopped the process from killing him.
Yeah, and there's no way that the material was going to be eliminated from the body, so it was an ongoing situation.
Do you remember what the chemical was that they used?
Polonium 236 or something.
It was something, you know, really potent. I remember that.
Yeah, the moment they injected him, he was dead. Or the moment he drank that drink, he was dead. But ARLP 76 got its start in life as an anti-cancer drug to suppress the cell growth.
Well, this is I think it's a company to follow. Their space connection was a little bit tenuous because she did talk about, you know, space tourists taking it prophylactically. But come on, even if you're going to go to a Bigelow Hotel in Leo for 2 weeks, you're not going to have a radiation issue, you know, unless you're a cancer survivor or something like that. Would you take it prophylactically on a mission to Mars? Those questions were unanswered. So the actual space connection and how it would be used with astronauts is a little bit up in the air still. But if they're successful with it, it's probably a game-changing medication. And she did talk about how it was different from their competition, but we'll go into that in hopefully better detail if they are able to come on the program and talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of it's the GTRs that are the real problem with radiation anyway. I mean, the flux coming off the sun, is you can protect against that fairly easily. But the GTRs that are the killer, they're only 1% are heavy ions, but that 1% is does a lot of damage. So if you could get a safe, effective drug that inhibited the damage from that kind of radiation, that would be a real game changer for space flight. Then you'd only have to worry about gravity. But I really enjoyed it, and I think you could have given any of those presenters, you know, some kind of letter or award saying, this is a good idea. I thought they were all good business, or potentially good businesses that the person might want to invest in.
I
really enjoyed it.
Anything else you want to talk about?
No, not really. I just let you know. I really thought that they turned a corner this year. That was a real professional level conference this year.
No, I agree, but I really want you to go see the come to church meeting from yesterday morning. And I, as I said, I'm gonna get a lot of entertainment out of that. But Rick may come on the show to talk about some of this in the near future. So. That was the only program like that at the entire conference, and I didn't have any conversations with anyone at the conference similar to that.
I haven't spoken to Rick Tomlinson since the 70s. That was back in the Gerard O'Neill days.
Well,
Gerard
O'Neill was clearly the biblical reference. Let me tell you, it must have come up 5 million times during that hour. There's no shortage of the altar of Gerard O'Neill. Trust me on that.
Yeah.
All right, I appreciate
it. I'll get off the line and let somebody else call in. Then.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, you have a good day.
You too. Bye bye. So, listeners, Jerry in Florida is vacated our toll-free line, and you're welcome to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. I had a blast one evening with Jerry when I was at ISU in Melbourne, and then that later in the week I drove up to Cocoa Beach to see some friends, and Jerry and I went to dinner on the Cocoa Beach pier, and we had a blast for several hours together. It was a lot of fun. Meeting space show listeners and hanging out together and stuff is a hoot. And, Jerry set a real high bar for that. And I wish I could get to Florida more often. I would be seeing him more often. We had a real fun evening together. And, if any of you get down there and you're space show fans and, you want to put a person together with Jerry who really knows the industry. I have to tell you, he is absolutely a true expert and very knowledgeable on space history and the space industry. Jerry's a go-to guy and a stand-up fellow and former Air Force person, and we just had a lot of fun together. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Hi, this is Elliot in Michigan.
Hi, Elliot in Michigan. How you doing?
I'm doing good, actually. I'm glad to get on. It's been pretty busy.
Yeah, for a change, we've been getting a lot of calls. What's on your mind? What city in Michigan are you in?
I am in rural northern Michigan,
okay.
But I'm actually all over the place, too. So.
All right. What's on your mind?
Well, I'd like to talk about the Mars program, if I may. And specifically the agenda of the Mars program, because right now the Mars Society is up in arms about the cancellation of future Mars missions. But talking to the people working on the Mars program, it doesn't appear to be the case. At least they don't seem to be so upset about it. I've had the opportunity to talk to some scientists working on the Mars program, who have worked on the Mars twin rovers as well as the Phoenix lander. And they seem to be nonchalant about it. And I'm curious if you personally, David, with your experience... talking to scientists, if they seem to be as upset about this as space advocates are.
First of all, I haven't really, all that fair with you, talked to specific Mars scientists about the cancellation of these missions. But the interesting thing is, I had this guest on a couple of days ago before I went to New Space. Brent Sherwood, who has his Mars idea, which is a little bit different than most people's, but he mentioned the 2018 mission, and I thought that was canceled. I didn't ask him about it because we were talking about something entirely different, but I think it was the MAVEN mission, And I thought MAVEN was canceled, but he mentioned it in the discussion as an ongoing mission. But honestly, I haven't heard anything about, gripes about this or that being canceled. I know that they have brought a guy out of retirement to try to do a low-cost kind of flyby, save-face Mars mission, to replace the two that were canceled. But I just haven't gotten any information. I know when Dr. Zubrin was on the show, to say that he was irate or pissed off is an understatement. For those of you familiar with Bob, you know that Bob's emotions are right out there on his sleeves, as you know. And so I would imagine the Mars Society itself would follow in footsteps. The interesting thing is that their coming conference, which is in Pasadena, and it's held, I believe, before Curiosity is supposed to land next Sunday, that a lot of people from JPL are coming over to talk to them and to participate in the program. So he's clearly got Mars mission scientists and experts supporting the Mars conference.
Right. What you said kind of mirrors my own experience. You get people who are passionate about Mars, which I would include myself among, who are upset about the fact that missions are being canceled. But at the same time, if I could use your program as a soapbox to stand on without monopolizing the time of the program, if there are members of the Mars Society listening, I'd like to ask them, what is it we really expect out of this? What is the objective of our Mars program? Because if it's to find life, if that's the ultimate objective, which I think it is, I think most people would agree that is part of it, if not the main facet, at least one of the main pillars, then we have to ask ourselves, is the current program the best way to do it? So if science is the ultimate goal, to find life, I have to ask members of the Mars Society who supposed to support the status quo, why is it out of the $2.6 billion that we spent on the current Mars rover that's either going to land or crash in a week, out of that $2.6 billion, only $100 million of that has been spent on actual science. The rest is all engineering. It's a very difficult statistic to deal with if the ultimate goal is science. It's hard to justify that.
Well, I don't know, but the new executive director of the Mars Society is a guest tomorrow to talk about the conference, and Susan Holden Martin is our guest at 2 p.m. California time, so she'd be a person to ask about this.
Well, perhaps I should call him in.
We'll be taking calls. People will have questions about the conference and what they're doing, and this clearly, is a legitimate question. I think most people I know in the advocate community and the enthusiast community are highly, highly supportive of our Mars program. And what I hear, like at the New Space Conference, which doesn't necessarily have a focus on Mars, but Mars is really included in the focus, is that settlement is the goal, and the most likely two places for settlement involve the Moon and Mars. So having a Mars program that leads to settlement, both in terms of whatever the government needs to do as well as whatever the private sector needs to do, is a huge plus. Mars is an extremely favorable topic, and I don't know of anyone who does not support an extended, even an enhanced Mars program. That said, when I did the show with Brent Sherwood the other day, and he delivered his recent GLEX paper on the program, he is of the opinion that human spaceflight to Mars is a total digression and a waste of resources and a program killer. And he goes through a whole analysis of all of this and says the highest value human spaceflight program is space, solar power, and geo, with people up there making that happen, fixing things, repairing things, doing logistics,
right,
and that going humans to Mars is a digression. And then off I went to New Space, and he would he'd be put in the storage cabinet of the Hyatt Hotel down there if he was expressing that. I don't think anyone would would listen, because the focus and the excitement is all about settlement and commerce, and Mars is a huge part of that.
Right. Well, I happen to agree with what he said. If this is the gentleman who was on your show a few days ago, I heard.
Yeah, I told him I don't agree with what he said at all. I think space solar power is, unless you want to subsidize electricity or take it off the market to drive prices up through the roof.
Well, hold on a second. Well, he gave a four-pronged approach of what we could do in space.
Yeah, but his number one is space. Yeah, his best use is space solar power.
Number one, which is, I'm skeptical.
You know, and he's got space tourism, although he didn't call it space tourism. He called it, I forget what the term was, but an enhanced space tourism industry. And then the moon, which the cislunar development program that we sometimes talk about on the show, and then number one was a human spaceflight to Mars that got the lowest value rating. And his paper's on the blog, listeners, if you want to go see what he's talking about. I posted it at the bottom of the archives on the blog, and I believe Brent was our guest Tuesday evening. It would have either been Monday or Tuesday evening. I forget which one he was on. Of just this past week. So go read his paper and see if you agree or not. But yeah, he had four options, including the human to Mars, which was the lowest valued option.
Right, right. Well, to touch on what you said, you mentioned, I think if the ultimate goal of going to Mars for people in the Mars Society is human habitation, I think that science, whatever scientific knowledge we could gather, the fastest with the most efficient expenditure of tax dollars would be best, because the ultimate information about Mars will allow it to happen. I don't personally think that's a viable option. Human beings on Mars, living underground with a shot in the arm for the radiation, seems far-fetched to me. But regardless, if you disagree with me on that, wouldn't a more efficient means to spend our money on the Mars program be better for all of us?
I don't understand
why there isn't more criticism of the way the money's being spent in the Mars program. It's as if whatever NASA does, we won't question it, because we don't want to do anything that might reduce JPL's budget. That's how it comes across to me.
I can't answer the question about the better use of NASA money. Clearly, if you're going to do humans to Mars in kind of the traditional safe fashion, we're talking several decades away, and the one thing that Brent did really well in that paper was list the technology advancements that have to be accomplished to be able to do that. On the other hand, Elon over at SpaceX and Zubrin talk about going to Mars vis-a-vis Dragon or something else, or you know, in a much shorter time. And their technological hurdles are resolved differently and over a different timeline than anything that Brent talks about at NASA. So, you know, SpaceX is run very differently than a government launcher program. So I don't know the proper, you know, answer to it, but I do know that humans to Mars and settlement and commerce are the three big drivers of space. The moon is not nearly as big a driver as humans to Mars. And if you officially did away with that, I don't know what it would do for impact in trying to move the space program forward. I know Brent didn't think it would do much. And in fact, he has been offering some suggestions of possible panelists to have the debate that he talked about on the show. And now that I'm out of the conference, I'll start giving some more attention to how we could do such a debate and keep it civil and keep it balanced between the debate participants, rather than having one person dominate and control and try to shut everybody else up, because I don't want to do that.
I would certainly be interested in hearing that debate. I think he was very well articulate, and although I don't agree with everything, I think the question has to be asked, and some reality needs to be brought into the circle.
Well, I don't think in terms of NASA, and certainly not in terms of Congress, that debate will ever take place. And it kind of did in a way with Augustine, you know, to a really loosey-goosey kind of way. But, you know, everybody's forgotten all of Augustine.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that, that the debate will never take place among NASA, because to share a very brief story, and I'll give you back your show. I had an opportunity to ask a gentleman who works for NASA here in Michigan, who's part of, I won't say what university, because he asked me not to repeat his name. But if you were to search the details of what I'm about to tell you, you'd probably figure out who it was. He's criticized the funding scheme of NASA and also some of the way science is done at NASA. And I posed to him the question of why we're not amortizing our Mars program the way that, say, the Russians get a particular piece of hardware working and they stick with it. Say the Soyuz. It's been going on for, 40 years now? It's the safest, most reliable, cheapest way to put humans in space. It works, essentially, to summarize it. And I wonder why we're not doing that with the Mars rovers. The obvious answer, immediate answer, is we can't put all the instruments that's on the Mars Science Laboratory onto a single rover, with Mars Twin Rover, which is true. But at the same time, with the type of cost it takes us, we could have built 9 of those things, over half a dozen of them, and launched them to different spots all around with smaller payloads, maybe not all the instruments, maybe mismatch the instruments on the different payloads depending on where they're going on Mars. But we're not doing that. We're spending a tremendous amount of money, and we're going to get very little from it if it crashes, as were if we'd sent 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 of these things, these smaller rovers, we would have had at least a couple of successes. So I asked this question to a NASA scientist here in Michigan, and his reply is, well, absolutely, that makes absolute sense, and everybody knows it. But we don't go to Mars for science. We go to Mars, and then he paused, and he went on to reiterate what Neil deGrasse Tyson has said about attracting people to engineering and sciences. And he says it's mainly driven by the military generals. Generals peek their heads into congressmen's office and mention, oh, by the way, at the end of the conversation, we need you to fund the Mars program because it gets kids to study math and science because they want to become astronauts. And then we funnel them away into secret op programs in the military. And I'd never heard somebody who takes a paycheck from NASA be so frank about it. And so matter of fact, as if he was saying something, so unheard of. And I'm wondering if behind closed doors, when the tape recorder is not rolling, if you've ever heard somebody who works for NASA reiterate that same opinion.
No. The only thing I've heard behind closed doors from different guests, unsolicited from me and from guests who have no idea that I have an interest in the subject, is not about Mars, but is about UFOs and extraterrestrial life. But I have never heard them say something along the lines that you're talking about.
Well, maybe he was an oddball. I don't know.
But I don't know. Look, if MSL works and Curiosity takes off roving around and you know, the instruments work, it'll be a hero project and everyone will love it, and it, you know, it'll be terrific.
Absolutely.
And if it, you know, if it smacks into the Martian surface at multiple thousands of miles an hour and it's blasted into smithereens, you can bet the criticism will just be outpouring from
everyone. Oh, yeah, congressional hearings and everything.
Oh, yeah, it'll be a real mess. I did talk to people at the conference who, not with NASA, but who work on a lot of JPL and NASA projects, and I said, okay, best guess, what do you think the likelihood of success is of Curiosity landing? And what I got consistently from everybody in their own words was NASA, JPL is really good at this stuff. They, you know, it was 2 years late, a lot of cost overruns. They really know how to test it. They are really good at making these kinds of engineering things work and da-da-da. And the consensus was, from maybe talking to 4 or 5 people, 80% chance of success. And I got that pretty much across the board from people.
It's pretty funny you should say that, because the gentleman who I was referring to, who is not a quack, I don't believe so, was on the advisory board that of NASA that decided to certify support for the Mars Science Laboratory, and I asked him what the chances of success were, and he said 70% chance of failure. So he claims that's a NASA number that hasn't leaked out, but that might be his own bias leaking into it as well.
Well, 1 week, we will find out the answer, right?
We will. We don't have much to wait. With that, I'll give you back your show. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for calling in. And if I'm able to put together the debate with Brent, which I would like to be able to do if we can find the right people to do it, I'll be sure to give heads up to everyone on the show.
Absolutely. That'd be great. Thank you, David.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Our toll-free is available again, listeners, if you want to call in. We still have a lot of time left. 1-866-687-7223. And yes, just as a reminder, you probably don't need any reminders, but Curiosity does land a week from today, August 5th. Now, it's interesting. It's August 5th here in California because it's 10:30 at night. But if you're on the East Coast, it's landing on August 6th. So don't get discombobulated by the time zone changes. I'm assuming I will be watching it on the computer, on NASA TV on the computer. I doubt that it'll be carried on any of my cable stations. 10:30 at night's not too late. But I will be glued to the thing. My email will be open. My Twitter account will be being monitored. So if any of you listening and you want to email me or exchange on Twitter, the Twitter feeds with all of the groups I'm following and that follow me, I'm sure will be, you know, giving better news out than anyone else. Probably many of the Twittering people will be there at JPL watching it in person. And you can email me lifetime because I will be up. I will be glued to watching it and holding my breath and crossing fingers and toes like everybody else. We have another caller. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is Tim from Huntsville.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'll make it real quick, okay? You said that someone is marketing a shot or injection for radiation?
Yeah, it's you can watch their business plan presentation on that Space Frontier archive page that I've been talking about. But, yeah, they have a medication made or altering a naturally occurring human protein.
Okay, is there any chance that NASA will test this for use in space?
We've been talking about that. We understand that people in NASA have contacted the company and are very interested in it. So, their ties to space are not as strong as their ties to national security, defense, and the oncology community, but they're absolutely going down the road of exploiting the space connection. That's why they were at the New Space Conference. And again, I would urge you to watch their business plan prep. I can't even think of the word, the presentation on the New Space site. I'll put out the URL for that in the archives on the Space Vidicast website. The specific one for the business plan presentation. There's probably a couple of them because it went over a couple of breaks. But yeah, I'm sure NASA's interested in it from what I heard while I was at the conference.
Okay, and she said, can get on the space show?
I invited her, and she said if they can talk freely, either she or their CEO might do it. So she has my card, and we've exchanged information, and I will be following up with her, and whether it happens or not, I guess depends upon the sensitivity that their CEO believes exist, given what they're doing, and do they want to talk on radio. It's one thing to talk in front of 200 people at a space conference and be very sort of regulated in what you talk about. But so I told her, I said, look, all you really need to do is we'll put your business plan presentation videos up on the blog, or if you have them on your own company website, we can direct listeners to that. And you or the CEO or whoever can take us through your presentation and then answer questions. And you don't have to go into any more detail on anything than you did at the conference. And so that is probably the best approach to avoid their giving away proprietary information or saying something they shouldn't say at too early a date. But I'm hoping they'll come on the show. They've been invited. I don't know what else to say.
Okay. One last question. Did you hear back from Dr. Casper yet?
No, he never replied to me.
Okay, I'll shoot him an email and see what.
Yeah, I was asking him for more information that I'm ignorant on the topic. I know a lot about regular fusion because I've done a lot of shows on that, but not on this particular topic. And I would appreciate him helping to update me and would be back in touch with him. And I never got a reply.
Okay. All right. There's something wrong with our email over there at UH. Sometimes I remember that I sent some emails to the professors, and some of them went into their spam file.
Well, he may never have gotten it. Then that, you know, that's becoming more and more common these days with email. So, but I didn't get any bounce back or spam notice. So,
all right, I'll go ahead and I'll send them a message. Okay.
Okay. If I can find the email real quick, I'll forward it to you, and then if you have better luck emailing him, you can tell him that this is what I sent him.
All right, I will.
Okay. Thanks, Tim.
No problem.
Bye-bye. And our toll-free is clear again. If any of you still want to call as we move toward a two-hour program, 1-866-687-7223. Programs next week, five of them, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday with Tim Pickens in the morning, Friday, and then Sunday, and then Dennis Wingo on Monday, no show on Tuesday, special show with AIAA on Thursday morning, typical Friday show, Sunday show, etc. We're back on schedule until early September, when I go to Pasadena for AIAA Space 2012. So, looks like everybody's slowing down on the phones. I want to thank Pooley. He wrote in about the radiation that the Cold War Russians dosed the British guy with, polonium, polonium 210. Is a short half-life, high-energy alpha decay particle, very toxic, was used as a neutron trigger in early A-bombs. It is made from bismuth, B-I-T-H-M-U-T-H, 209, in a reactor. And from what I understand, it is a terrific-tasting cocktail, but you probably don't want to drink it. Thank you, Charles, by the way. 1-866-687-7223. I think somebody else a year or two later was dosed with polonium. I think it happened again, so I thought maybe I'm confusing it with something I might have seen on TV because it became a popular TV story for a lot of TV shows. Even the old doctor show House had a program where they thought somebody was dosed with, a government guy in a foreign location was dosed with something radioactive to kill him, but they turned out to be a nut that he was eating and having a reaction to. But I thought there was another one that got dosed by it too, but again, I may be confusing that with a TV show. 1-866-687-7223. It's interesting to speculate on what would happen if absolutely officially and there was a concerted effort to remove from our consciousness and our space enthusiasm agenda human space flight to Mars anytime in the next 100 or 200 years, if it just was like forbidden and we couldn't think about it, talk about it, and we had to find other rationales for space. I'm wondering what impact that would have on inspiring young kids. I do know there are a lot of young kids who want to save the world, so space solar power does appeal to them. It was talked about at the conference that I just attended. And companies in their business plans and also when they were presenting on panels and things like that, other companies, you know, that were speakers, they all talk about how we need green technologies and this, that, and the other. So, you know, there is a lot of interest and commitment to things other than human spaceflight. But I just wonder what would happen if it were removed or seriously downplayed in our consciousness. Would it adversely impact the energy flowing into space development at this time? It would be a pretty interesting study to look at that question and really see if we couldn't get some objective factual data on it. Doesn't look like anybody else wants to call, so a two-hour show is going to be what it is. So again, we're coming up on that line, so if anybody wants to use the phone, you got to hurry up and do it. It is 1-866-687-7223. Another person I talked to at the conference who will be returning to the show in the near future is Dr. Pete Warden, General Pete Warden. And he had a lot of interesting things to say on some of the panels and as a major speaker. So he'll be back on. Also, Colonel Coyote Smith will be back on soon. And he's now over at Maxwell Air Force College. I think he's the director of admissions or one of the key people in running the Air College. And I got a chance to see Coyote and visit with him again. So we'll probably be bringing Coyote back on the show in the near future as well. So, listeners, I want to thank you for participating in today's program, for calling in, for talking with us. And it always works better with a lot of phone calls, which we had today, so I'm glad to hear that. We do have another Open Lines program planned in August. Let me see if I can pull that date up for you real quick, because I know many of you don't really go to the website newsletter that often, even though that has the full schedule. But we've got an Open Lines coming up in August. Let me tell you when it is. Da-dum-da-dum. We also have a webinar coming up in August. I'll tell you about that in a second, too. Open Lines, Tuesday night, August 21st. You know who's on Friday morning, August 24th? Do you guys know who actually was the key guy planning the Apollo landing sites? For those of you who used to listen to the early days of Art Bell on Coast to Coast, this name will ring a bell to you. Dr. Farouk Elbaz is going to be our guest. What a treat this is going to be to talk to him. I am really looking forward to that. Sunday, August 19th is probably our next space show webinar, and it's going to be addressing topics of the choice of the Secure World Foundation, and Brian Whedon will be one of our webinar guests, and retired Air Force General Jim Armour, who's been on the show before, and who was also, by the way, at New Space. He works for ATK over on the East Coast. He's going to be with us, as well as others, and I don't have the time yet for this program, but we're pretty sure it's going down on Sunday, August 19th, and there'll be much more information about that once I'm able to confirm the time and all the players, but we're excited about that, so you want to make sure to mark down Sunday, August 19th. Okay, listeners, I appreciate your tuning in. Mars Society tomorrow with their new executive director, Miss Martin, is our guest. And you're welcome to call in and talk to her. Mars Society, their conference, anything goes, okay? Charles Pooley just got in a note in response to my comment about polonium, and he said, yes, PO, that must be the abbreviation for it, PO-210 has been used several times by the USSR. Charles, this time it was just used by Russia because the USSR hasn't been around for a long time. Quick, 100% fatal, and very scary. Yes, I guess it would be, given you'd have no clue that you've just drunk your death, and within a week you're going to be meeting your maker and whoever else you think is up there or down there or wherever you go. Thank you, Charles, for the PO 210 update. Listeners, again, thank you. Have a great upcoming week, okay? Be safe. Have fun. Be productive. And the countdown is on for Mars Curiosity. Oh, one more reminder. Don't hang up, anybody. Come on, listen to this. Got a good one for you. Okay, Anita, Dr. Anita, boy, I hope I don't botch this, Sengupta, S-E-N-G-U-P-T-A, of JPL. She is our expert on John Batchelor, Hotel Mars, Wednesday night. You know what she did? She is the entry, descent, and landing engineer on the Curiosity team and other teams as well. And she designs the big capacity, huge, humongous parachutes. So I have Dr. Anita Sengupta, EDL and Advanced Technologies, JPL, as our expert with John Batchelor and myself Wednesday on the Batchelor Show. Now, that is 6:30 p.m. California time for roughly 11 or 12 minutes, and it is 9:30 p.m. Eastern time. New York. John is in New York, and the streaming, for those of you, if you want to hear it live, instead of when I archive it on my website, is on WABC. And that website is wabcradio.com. And you look for the Batchelor Show, okay? And again, 6:30 California time Wednesday, and that's August 1st, and 9:30 Eastern time. Mars entry, descent, and landing team member, parachute designer, very cool person. I've heard her do other interviews on other radio, Dr. Anita Sengupta. I hope I'm not ruining her last name pronunciation, S-E-N-G-U-P-T-A. It's a short segment, as you know, on Hotel Mars with Mr. Batchelor. Don't miss it. This will be a great preview for Curiosity's landing on the surface of Mars the evening of August 5th, Sunday, August 5th, California time, August 6th on Eastern time. Seriously, that's it, guys, gals. Thank you for listening to The Space Show. Come to the New Space Conference next year. It's turned a corner. I don't know how else to say it. I'm still high from having had a really cool, fun, great conference experience from Wednesday afternoon through late last night at the banquet, which I did leave early. I had an hour and a half drive to get home, and I was really tired, so I didn't stay for the final award. Thank you all for listening again. Safe and great week for you, your loved ones, and your family, and of course, for space. We love you at the Space Show. Thanks for tuning in.